we've had three good weeks, and one bad week can make all that look, you know, go downhill.
Today we begin our DenverBroncos.com podcast with that quote from TJ Ward. I asked him about how well the defense was playing and how proud they were just about a week or two ago, and how true those words ring now after the loss to New England. We'll get into what happened in that game in just a few minutes here, and we'll have plenty of more to talk about with the Broncos reaching the midway point in their season. The divisional race is getting closer, and on Sunday, the Broncos will take to the road again to face the Raiders. Before we delve into all that, let's take a look at what happened elsewhere last week. Just about every division has a close race going right now, and this past weekend's games didn't quite give any team a bigger cushion. That is, except for the Arizona Cardinals. Arizona now leads the league in winning percentage, and with their win over Dallas, they're the only team with a two-game division lead. The NFC South and East both had shakeups at the top, with New Orleans beating Carolina on Thursday night, and the Eagles moving to 6-2 over the Cowboys. Focusing on the AFC North real quick, all four teams are over 500. The Ravens are at the bottom at a measly 5-4, and the Bengals are on top at 5-2-1. Meanwhile, the Steelers are on one heck of a recent kick, as they've won each of their last three games, of which the worst opponent was a 4-5 Texans team. Their offense has been phenomenal in that time, with Roethlisberger completing 74% of his passes for an average of about 375 yards a game, and a total of 14 passing touchdowns in that time. I mean, yeah, it's a small sample size and all that, but their performance as of late is pretty outstanding. And in recent Broncos news, we have injury updates on Monte Ball and Nate Irving. Monte was back at practice on Wednesday, a month to the day after his groin injury that he suffered against the Cardinals in the third quarter of that game. Linebacker Nate Irving, unfortunately, will miss time with a knee sprain. Irving got hit in the fourth quarter against the Patriots, and he did not return in that match. For more on that game last week, let's get into our game review with Andrew Mason. After more than a month of winning ways, it all came to a crashing halt in Foxborough on Sunday. For all the concern and early snowfall raised, the snow was cleared from the field well before kickoff, and the sun even broke through the clouds as the game began. The start was tough for both teams, but the Patriots reeled off a 24-point run in the second quarter, and defensive problems compounded quickly. Turnovers set up New England with short fields, and they managed to convert third downs at a healthy rate, and Tom Brady got out of long yardage situations without too much difficulty, though he didn't get pinned into those situations very often. Special teams had its own problems, and the offense couldn't make up ground. Though Peyton Manning threw for 438 yards, the offense converted only 3 of 11 third downs and none of their fourth down conversion attempts. And then the injuries to Welker, his back, and Irving, his knee, just made the game all the worse. The locker room after the game was a somber one, with the defense noting their errors and addressing what they need to do moving forward. Now, as we move forward, columnist Andrew Mason joins me to talk about this game. Well, the most basic question here is, what the heck went wrong? But that's probably got a lot of answers. Let's start with something a little bit more central. What did you think was the biggest weakness that the Broncos showed against the Patriots?
It's tough. I mean, I'd say it's a dead heat between protection up front on the offensive line and also creating holes for the running game, and also the defense's ability to get set and get adjusted and react to what a quick strike, quick snap offense like Tom Brady and the Patriots can do. But the offensive line, I think, I'm going to go with as the top concern, because it's, even though they've been doing better on the run in October and has stepped back against New England, obviously, there were some issues that have come up over the season that came up again and anew against New England. In particular, the inability to get a push off the snap. I mean, Vince Wilfork in particular was having his way in the middle against the Broncos offensive line. And also that I go back to that fourth down sack in the second quarter, and it was a three-man rush, and one man just comes up the middle, and no one picks him up the A-gap. And it was similar to a couple of sacks that you saw in the Jets game back in October, when, you know, two of their sacks came on three-man rushes. I mean, 3-on-5, that's the one situation where you expect your offensive line, even if the quarterback rolls out and has to buy time, you expect the offensive line to provide protection. And, you know, when they're letting a guy come free up the A-gap and Peyton Manning really doesn't have much of a chance, that's troubling, I think. And when you've seen it, you know, three times in a four-game stretch, a scenario that usually maybe you allow one or two sacks over a season at most, and when you see it that often in that short a span and you see the mistakes repeating themselves, that's where you get concerned. So I'll say the offensive line is what you've got to be concerned with after that game.
The broader look at this, what do you take away from that loss and learning about this Broncos team? Or in other words, how concerning was that game for them going forward?
It's concerning, but it's nothing to start hitting the panic button about, certainly. I mean, it's still a 6-2 team. The schedule on the back half is considerably weaker. If you look at win percentage, look at overall team strength, considerably weaker in the second half than the first half. You know, the last 3 weeks in particular, as Chris Harris said a couple weeks ago to me, it was the gauntlet. And the Broncos got through that particular three-week gauntlet 2-1. So can they improve? Can they get better? Can they pick up what they lost to New England and now they're a half game back for home field advantage? Sure, they can pick that up. But at the same time, when you've got some fundamental issues, and to go back to what I said about the offensive line, when you've got fundamental issues that are popping up from time to time in multiple games, that's something you've got to focus on and fix. And maybe, you know, that's where you're going to have to tweak a few things. Maybe you're going to have to keep a tight end in more often, or maybe you're going to have to consider another change on the offensive line after, you know, Paul Kornick has started now for the last three games. Maybe you consider another change if they're still allowing sacks on three-man rushes. So, you know, it's, on the whole, they're doing very well, and you can't really complain about being 6-2 against that schedule. But at the same time, you know, you can identify certain weak spots that, if they're allowed to fester and grow, will torpedo this team's chances of winning the Lombardi Trophy at the end of the year.
Going into the locker room after the game, it was pretty quiet afterward. Almost tangible waves of frustration, disappointment going through that locker room. Have you seen games like these? Have you seen them become turning points for teams?
Sure. Even in the recent past, I mean, you can look at resounding losses for teams that went on to win it all. I mean, I think one that Broncos fans know quite well is Week 15 of the 2012 season when Denver went into Baltimore, a place that had been a house of horrors for the Broncos over the years, and dismantled the Ravens. And that was a Ravens team that was in a little bit of a disarray at that point. They just changed offensive coordinators, moving Jim Caldwell into that spot. It looked to be a team that was in chaos and on the verge of having its season implode. After that loss, they turned around the next week and they throttled the Giants at home. They got to the playoffs and they went on the run that of course included beating the Broncos in the playoffs 4 weeks later. So yeah, I mean, I could see that loss being like that for the Broncos. Obviously, it's not a team that's in anywhere near the same point of disarray as the Ravens were in 2012. I wouldn't even say the Broncos are in any kind of disarray. They've got things to fix, like I discussed, but it's still a team that's pretty well put together and has a lot more positives than negatives. But what a loss like that can do, I think, is crystallize the fact that, A, there are things that need to be fixed. I think sometimes when you go on a long winning streak and you have a lot of success and you're not really tested, you know, human nature kicks in and tells you, hey, okay, we're doing fine. The results are fine. What do we need to change? A game like Baltimore reminds everybody that, okay, we're not perfect. There's things at which we can get better. And players and coaches, they can talk about that even when things are going well. If they're on an 8-9 game winning streak, they can talk about, oh, everything, you know, we're still working week to week. But there's that little human thing that clicks in the back of our minds. It's just the way we're wired as human beings that says, well, maybe, you know, we're doing fine. Maybe what more do I need to do? Losing 43-21, the worst regular season loss since late in the 2011 season at Buffalo, that tells you, okay, we got some things to fix. Can it be a turning point? Yes, and I think we'll have a good idea on whether it's a positive turning point after the Broncos come back from Oakland.
Even with the loss, the Broncos are still ahead of the division. The middle of the pack got a little bit more muddled on Sunday between San Diego and Kansas City. And with that, let's head to the AFC West rundown. David Deschant and Lauren Judici are back yet again to give us the scoop on the Broncos' divisional foes. David, let's begin in Miami.
The Chargers took a bit of a heavy blow. They lost 37-0, got shut out in Miami. Once atop the division, they have now moved into third. David, what the heck went wrong in this game for San Diego?
Well, really, it was just about everything went wrong. Chargers' first possession was actually their best of the day by far. They drove from their own 20 to the opposing 20 about, and then went for it on fourth and one. Brandon Oliver was stuffed, and it was pretty much all downhill from there. The Chargers' offense, I believe, the rest of the game, at least while Phillip Rivers was in the game, which was through the end of the third quarter, they didn't gain more than 17 yards on a single drive. Even once Kellen Clemens went in there for Phillip Rivers, the best he could do was 23 yards on one drive. This was utter domination, specifically on the Dolphins' defensive side. They came into the game with one of the league's best pass defenses, especially pass per play average. And they showed it in this game. Like I mentioned, Phillip Rivers left the game. That was it was said that he had a hand injury, questionable return. Sounds like he would have returned if the game was close. Obviously, they didn't want to risk anything, but it looked like he just got his elbow or his hand hit on a sack fumble late in the game. It was his fourth turnover of the game, which is something we haven't seen from Phillip Rivers lately. He's been excellent lately. He threw three interceptions in this game and fumbled once. So certainly not the best performance by him. Unfortunately, it was bad on the other side of the ball too. Dolphins offense moved the ball like crazy. They scored on seven of their first nine drives. On one of those, they missed a field goal. It could have been worse. They stalled in the red zone a couple times and kicked field goals. I mean, this was an absolute blowout, and perhaps one of the worst things about it for San Diego is that the Dolphins would have dominated the game even without those turnovers. It was 27-0 before the second turnover happened. I mean, this game was long gone, and the Chargers really don't have anything to hang their hats on.
As I mentioned, they took that loss and now move into third place with Kansas City winning and going into second at 5-3. It kind of feels like this could be a slippery slope as San Diego continues to slide on this three-game losing streak. What do you make of their futures going ahead?
Well, we talked about it last week. The Chiefs might be the better team than the Chargers, is what we were saying last week, and it certainly looked like that yesterday. Now, I don't think the Chargers are as bad as we saw in this game. Hopefully, you can chalk it up to traveling all the way across the country. It's one of the longest trips that anybody makes all year, and playing a morning game on the East Coast, and we see that teams have trouble with that sometimes. Now, the Chargers didn't have trouble with it in Buffalo this year, but they haven't won in Miami, I believe, since 1981, the famous Kellen Winslow game. So it's understandable that they would struggle there. Hopefully, you can chalk up the blowout to that. But there are definitely some things that need to change moving forward. We've talked about their offensive line woes. Phillip Rivers was being bothered constantly in this game. People at his feet, people in his throwing lanes. He had to move around, and he's done that well most of the year, but he was pressing in this game because they were behind, and that led to the interceptions. Rich Ornberger, we've talked about him many times as their backup center. He suffered an injury in this game after he committed a holding penalty. Chris Watt came in, a rookie, to play. It's just a lot of turnover there on the offensive line right now, and it's difficult to be solid when that's happening. Another big issue that we keep seeing that's cropping up is the pass rush just isn't there. They're not bothering opposing quarterbacks. Ryan Tannehill had all day to throw. They moved some pockets a little bit. You know, the offensive coordinator, Bill Lazor, comes from the Chip Kelly school of thought on offense, so he built in some quick throws and moving pockets and that sort of thing, but they still didn't get near Tannehill. He was able to sit back there, do what he wanted, and really pick apart the Chargers' defense. Even more worrisome, the corners are really not sticking to receivers the way we saw early in the year when they were holding teams under 21 points every week. Jason Verrett, their rookie slot corner, who's been great, he's been hurt, and I think that's hurt them a lot. When you're missing a top corner, we've seen it from a lot of teams, it pushes the quality of each corner after that down, and that seemed to certainly be the case on Sunday. So those things are going to have to change if the Chargers are going to be better. Their defense wasn't great last year, and their offense was able to, you know, compensate for it with long drives and lots of time of possession. But when you get against a good team that's moving the ball on offense and taking the time of possession for itself, that becomes a problem.
Coming up for the Chargers, what do they do in the next couple weeks?
Well, luckily for them, they have a bye And that'll be good this week because they need one. They need a rest. They need to get some players healthy. They need to get Verrett healthy. They need to get Manti Te'o healthy, who hasn't been. DJ Fluker's been bothered by an ankle. That could help, give him time to get a little fresher. Rich Ornberger, like we mentioned, so you don't have to go to another center. I think Philip Rivers will be fine. I think this game was really a product of him pressing and having people at his feet. So he should be okay moving forward. They go against Oakland the first week after the bye, and we'll see how well they've recovered and see if they can get back into the AFC West race. They do get the Chiefs and the Broncos once more each. They host the Broncos. They have to go to Kansas City, but certainly they'll need to win both of those games to give themselves a good shot in the division.
Thanks, David. And now it's time for our favorite recurring segment. Why did the Raiders lose this week? Lauren, why did the Raiders lose this week?
Well, the Raiders are officially off to their worst start since 1962. Give your hats off to the Raiders. You know, they were within six of the reigning champions, and it's no secret that the Seahawks aren't what they were last year, but, you know, it's pretty impressive that they kept it that close on the road at CenturyLink Field. And, you know, there are a couple interesting scores in this game that were definitely game changers. You know, a pick six by the Seahawks and a blocked punt recovered in the end zone for the Raiders. The Raiders actually got on the board first with a field goal, but the Seahawks took a 14-3 lead to close the first quarter after a Marshawn Lynch 3-yard touchdown run and a Bruce Irvin pick six. And Lynch would get in the end zone one more time in the first half, and the Seahawks went into the locker room at the end of the half with a 24-3 lead. But once that second half hit, the Raiders really started chipping away at that lead. The Raiders blocked a punt, and Bryce Butler recovered it in the end zone. And, you know, in a perfectly placed pass on fourth and goal at the one, Derek Carr hit Rivera in the end zone. And, you know, that slowly the Raiders kind of fought their way back. And I think that's really a testament to this team. The Raiders defense held the Seahawks to two field goals in that second half. Derek Carr, while he did help forge a near comeback, you know, is probably one of his worst games in his career. You know, he finished the game 24-41 for 194 yards, two touchdowns, and two interceptions. And like I said, one of those picks was a pick six. I think he knows that he needs to make those big plays and takes those chances for this offense to gain new momentum and for this team to potentially get that first win. And a large part of that is because this run game cannot gain any momentum. Only twice this season have the running backs eclipsed more than 100 yards, and on Sunday they can only muster up 37. Darren McFadden had 20 yards on 13 attempts for a mere 1.5 yard average. And again, this is going against Seattle in Seattle, so we all knew it wasn't going to be an easy task, but I think it's really clear that someone needs to step up for this team to get a win. It seems like this team cannot put all phases of the game together. You know, it seems like once the defense started getting its act together, the offense began falling apart and not pulling its weight. But yeah, I gotta say, the defense just couldn't make key stops when it needed to. While the Seahawks were held to those two field goals in the fourth quarter, those 6 points ended up being the margin of victory. And those two drives really ate up the clock in that last quarter and really doomed the Raiders, and they didn't have any time to, you know, they tried the onside kick, but, you know, only less than 2 minutes left after that. So, you know, that time that they spent on the field really ended the Raiders' chances of winning that game. And but they really kept Russell Wilson under control, and he completed a season low of 48.6% of his passes and produced his second lowest quarterback rating of the season. And they also did a relatively solid job of containing his legs. And obviously he's a dual threat quarterback, and, you know, the Broncos really struggled with containing him. But during this game, he only had 8 rushes for 31 yards, and that includes one 19-yard run. But it's the same story every week. They were on the field way too much, and they were exhausted by the end of the game. Their offense couldn't stay on the field, and it seems like it's been a pretty similar storyline each week for these Raiders, and they just can't put a game together in all three phases and for 60 minutes.
Still, for, you know, the second half, they outscored the Seahawks 21-6, I believe. So there's got to be something positive they can take away from that, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what the Raiders have shown these past few weeks is that they really do have a lot of fight in them. And, you know, while they're 0-8, I really don't think that they can be overlooked. The defense did a good job of containing Wilson. They're taking steps forward in their third down conversion rate, allowing their second lowest percentage of the season. And the only time they were more successful on third down was last week against Cleveland. And as you remember from the first few weeks, that was a point that they really struggled with. They could not get off the field on third down, even third and long, and it was really a struggle. And you know, they're taking steps forward in that. And, you know, this game was also their second lowest yards allowed and the lowest completion percentage allowed to an opposing quarterback. And special teams looked great that with that blocked punt recovered in the end zone. And, you know, the Raiders are getting better and taking steps forward. And it's just tough because the schedule is so killer. And they've lost 6 of 8 games this season by 11 points or less. And Charles Woodson said, for a franchise to start winning, it needs to have a signature moment or play. And I really believe that the Raiders can turn this around. They just kind of need that moment, that spark. And while they need that spark, they also need to put a whole game together in all three phases. And unfortunately for the Raiders, tough schedule, and their next three games are all AFC West opponents. And first the Broncos at home, the Chargers in San Diego, and then the Chiefs at home. And you got to think that after the Broncos' tough loss in Foxborough, they'll be pretty excited to head to Oakland and face the winless Raiders.
Thank you, Warren. And finally, the Chiefs are now at 5-3 after their 24-10 win over the Jets. The Kansas City offense was efficient enough in the first half to rest on their laurels in the second as their defense took care of business. They scored on 3 of their 4 drives in the first half, all touchdowns. And the Jets' first half wasn't all bad. Their first couple drives were over quickly and resulted in punts. But Michael Vick, starting instead of Geno Smith, led the Jets 81 yards down the field for a touchdown. And after a 65-yard kickoff return, they managed to get a field goal before the half ended. The Jets weren't that bad in the half, but their defense couldn't get off the field enough to help their offense. Then, in the second half, Kansas City didn't allow the Jets to get much of anything, especially when it came to extending drives. They converted just 1 of 7 third downs of the half, and after their first drive of the third quarter went 3 and out, each of their next 3 drives ended on downs. Mike Vick later had a head injury, and Matt Sims, brother of Chris, son of Phil, entered the game, and that didn't help their chances much. Not that they were having any success in the half anyway. The Chiefs have continued their strong play of late, with a mostly unperturbed offensive game that did what it had to. Alex Smith didn't make many mistakes, and those mistakes were easy to brush off. Jamaal Charles had 78 yards on the ground to help out too, and their defensive effort really stepped up with execution on third down. Their pass rush again looked great, and Justin Houston had 2 sacks, giving him a league-leading 12 sacks on the season thus far, and Don Terry Poe had a sack on Vic as well. Looking ahead down the line, the Chiefs are now second in the division and have a decent road to face the leaders in Denver at the end of November. They go to Buffalo this Sunday, face the Seahawks at home the following week, and then play the Raiders on the road on a short week on the following Thursday. The division is far from set at this point, and only 1.5 games between the top 3 teams. And then there's Oakland. Speaking of Oakland, let's get to our preview of the upcoming divisional matchup between them and the Broncos. No introduction necessary for these Raiders. They're starting a rookie quarterback who's trying to find his footing, but without much running game, their offense isn't getting much, at last in the league in total yards per game. The defense isn't much better, allowing about 47% on third down conversions and providing only 6 takeaways on the season. When Peyton Manning talked to the media on Wednesday, he said that he's not looking at the records. What he's looking at is the tape. For fans, you know, it's easy to focus on the 0 in front of the 8 for the Raiders' record. What do you look at when you're evaluating the Raiders?
I look at the players they've got in particular. I look at the quality of the roster overall. It's strong in some places, and certainly I think they've got, to their benefit, they've got the 2 guys, one on offense, one on defense, that can be the primary building blocks. I'm talking about Derek Carr on offense, and who's had much more positive than negative, I think, certainly, and looks the part of a budding franchise quarterback in this league, just needs time and to overcome some mistakes, and probably better talent around him, frankly. And then on defense, Khalil Mack, who based on some of the questions asked of John Fox this week, when he was asked about Khalil Mack, maybe he's getting a little flack from some Raider fans and media about not having any sacks, but when I watched the film of him, he's just all over the place. A phenomenal run defender in particular, but also a guy who's capable of disrupting teams with a pass rush. ProFootballFocus.com has him credited to 23 hurries right now over the course of the year. Incredibly disruptive in almost every situation. You know, I look at the Raiders and, yeah, I see 0-8, but I also see a team, I also see pieces that are going to be part of making the Raiders competitive and growing that team over the next couple of years to where it's going to be one that causes a lot of problems for a lot of other teams down the line. And I see flashes of brilliance already. Let's go back to the San Diego game for the Raiders last month, and they pushed San Diego to the end before falling by 3 points. And, you know, if Derek Carr doesn't make a rookie mistake going for too much too soon on what could have been a game-tying or game-winning drive at the end of regulation, maybe we're talking about the Raiders not being winless at this point. So they're getting closer. I think Tony Sperano has certainly amped up the day-to-day intensity in practice for them, and I think it's getting results. They don't look like an 0-8 team to me. I know they've lost every game, but what I see is a team that they do shoot themselves in the foot a little bit, but they also force opponents' mistakes. You saw against Seattle last week, they, you know, in all three phases, particularly on defense and on special teams, really, you know, put the screws to the Seahawks at times and really force them to fight for a home win that I don't think they were expecting to fight for in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, they've got some good enough players to where if you're not on guard against these guys, they're capable of the upset.
Going back to looking at rookie Derek Carr, we've seen the Raiders really rely on him a lot. Their running game hasn't gotten going very much, and so they've really looked to him to throw 40-something times often. What have you seen from him specifically that gives Raider fans hope possibly for the future?
I've seen just the complete package. I love that, you know, I love his poise that he shows. And again, you know, there are some throws he'd like to have back, but those are rookie throws that he's making that he'd like to have back. He's going to learn from them. I see a guy who looks very comfortable when he moves out of the pocket, you know, and has a strong enough arm to where when he rolls right, he doesn't necessarily cut off the left side of the field to throw. I mean, he still has every receiver, every route, every point of the field at his disposal. So you've got to be very careful when you defend him. But I also see a guy who's getting like next to no help from a lot of guys on his team. There's not a great receiver on the team. You know, the running game, Darren McFadden, and when he gets a hole, he can do something with it. But he's not getting the holes very often. You know, it's an offense that is at a very embryonic stage of its construction. They're going to build around Derek Carr, but they need a lot of pieces that they don't have right now to consistently move the football. So what you're trying to do if you're the Raiders this year, you're trying to do everything possible and let Derek Carr grow, and you're also trying to do everything possible to keep him upright and keep him healthy. You don't, you know, I hate to bring his brother David Carr into this, but you don't want to have what happened to David Carr happen to Derek Carr. And that was, David Carr was with an expansion team, Houston, back in 2002. They had a horrible offensive line because the guy that expected to be the linchpin, Tony Boselli, that they picked in the expansion draft, was hurt and never played a down for Houston. So Carr spent, you know, David Carr spent his first couple of years basically running for his life quite a bit, and even though by his second year he had Andre Johnson to throw to, you know, when you're not getting proper protection and you're taking hits, it causes your internal pass rush clock to kind of malfunction just a little bit, and David Carr never seemed to recover from that. He was always a bit skittish, and he didn't have a good feel for the pass rush. And it really hindered his development. He never became the quarterback that I think he could have been in a better situation. So that's why if you're the Raiders, you're, you know, okay, yeah, you want to win games right now and you want to show some progress. But the best thing they can do for their long-term hopes is make sure that you help Derek Carr's development, that you protect him, that you don't put him into situations where he develops bad habits. They're 0-8. You know, they're not going to the playoffs. They're not getting anything out of this year other than laying a foundation. It's obviously not what they expected, but I think, you know, I think they're real. They're realistic about where they stand. So everything has to be predicated on preserving and growing those key parts for the future, like Carr and Khalil Mack. Now, Khalil Mack, I think, is already there as a great player. I think Carr can get there, but I think as a quarterback, there's so much more involved with the development that they've got to make sure they safeguard his development above all, even if that means costing him wins right now.
For the Broncos, following that big loss, do you see this game against Oakland as one they kind of rehang their reputation, rehang their hat on?
I think so. I think it's something that I know quite a few media have said on the side of the field and on the radio this week. After last week's game, you probably don't want to be the Raiders facing the Broncos. You know, a bit angry after the loss, a bit frustrated. Certainly, it seems like they've really gone into the film room and they've been candid and frank about their shortcomings against New England, and they've tried to adjust to that. Again, to go back to what I mentioned in an earlier segment, you know, a loss like that can really galvanize a team if they learn from it. If it forces everyone to just work that little bit harder and know that there are flaws that need to be corrected. So, you know, Oakland's going to be the first chance to test that, and I expect nothing less than the Broncos coming out on Sunday afternoon as though they're shot from a cannon, and I expect them to have a very strong rebound.
I'm going to go ahead and cut this preview a little bit short because I want to make sure we have time to get in this midseason retrospective. We're 8 games in the season, 6-2, half the year's behind us, and looking at where we're at now, top in the division, only losses are to two exceptional teams, Seattle, last year's Super Bowl winners, of course, and New England. How do you assess this team's performance midway through?
You have to be positive. I mean, certainly maybe you'd say, if you were grading, you'd say A-, and the minus comes in the form of a couple of losses, and certainly, you know, going to the halfway point on probably their worst performance of the season against New England, and obviously the worst result. But look at the quality of the wins over the course of the first 8 games. You know, they're the only team to beat Arizona, beat them resoundingly, although I think we can all agree that if they're not down to their third quarterback, Logan Thomas, by the third quarter, it's probably not a 41-20 win, but I still think the Broncos win that game. So when you've got the only negative mark on a team that's otherwise unbeaten, that's an outstanding win. You know, very good win to open the year over Indianapolis. Big wins over San Diego and Kansas City and San Francisco. You look at, the quality of their wins is probably second to none in the league overall. So can't really complain about the result. I think if you looked at the schedule and said, hey, the Broncos are 6-2 at midseason, most people would have been like, okay, fine, sounds good. Let's go from there. You know, they're in a good spot, better than expected play from Emmanuel Sanders, I think. I mean, I think we all thought he'd be good, but I don't think everyone thought that he would be as complete, you know, not the guy that can beat you short, the guy that can beat you deep, the guy that can really do everything on the outside. Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, they've had combined for 17 sacks. They're everything you thought they were going to be as tandem pass rushers. The injury to Dane Trevathan, or injuries, I should say, have not affected the linebacker corps because Brandon Marshall has played so well. Now another test, obviously, with Nate Irving going down. But, the Broncos' depth has passed plenty of tests before. We'll see how it does. I think if you're disappointed in anything right now, it's probably the aforementioned offensive line and the pressure they're allowing and the fact that it took four games to get any kind of semblance of production from the running game, and you had a lot of times where running backs being met in the backfield, particularly in the first 3 games, and then again against New England. So, you know, that's kind of where you say, okay, there's some more work to do. And obviously, that was an area where there were some changes anyway, and there have been more changes, you know, during the year with Paul Kornick coming in for Chris Clark. So some of that may be related to just shaking things up, getting Ryan Clady back in there, him returning from the foot injury. you know, there's some issues there, but over time I could see them being fixed. So on the whole, you have to be okay with where the Broncos are right now.
And last up, I want to hear what your top performers are on offense and defense. Just one from each is all I need, but if you want to give more, go ahead.
Well, on offense, it's obviously going to be Peyton Manning. League record for touchdown passes that he surpassed last month, and just having another season for the ages. But, you know, that who's the standout behind that? And I kind of go relative to what I expected. And I really thought that Emmanuel Sanders, I thought he was going to have a good year, but I thought it would be where he really turned up in the second half because, you know, you get in here, it takes time to get the new timing with a new quarterback. Well, that timing's been there since day one, it seems like. I mean, Peyton Manning to Emmanuel Sanders, looks like they've been doing this for years together and flourishing. So I'd say beyond Peyton Manning, Emmanuel Sanders is the guy I'd point to on offense. On defense, yeah, I'm going to cop out and say two guys again. Because, and I'm going to say, start with Von Miller. He's having a phenomenal year. He's having a year that's brought him right back to his 2012 level. Maybe even better, because I think he's getting better in the ground in defending the run. He's always had the pass rush, but as a run defender, he took some big steps from 2011 to 2012. More steps now from 2012 into 2014. I think we're going to look back at 2013 and just say, like, what the heck happened? That's going to be the outlier. And obviously, he had the ACL, and he had the 6-game suspension. And while he was suspended, he put on some weight that he's taken off since. So we may look back at Von Miller's career when it's all done, you know, and say, what the heck happened in 2013? Because there's going to be all these other seasons with, like, 11 sacks and, you know, 17, 18 sacks. I think he's going to put up those kind of numbers for his entire career. And then elsewhere on the defense, Chris Harris Jr., you know, another guy who came back from a torn ACL, just a terrific year. You know, he's ceded a lot of the slot work to Bradley Roby, which has allowed him to focus more on playing on the outside. And he's just been terrific. He's locking down, you know, one receiver after another. Great tackler. Rarely allows any substantial yardage after the catch. Defensive leader. Stand up guy in the locker room, you know, with no matter whether things are good or bad, you know, he's gonna answer the questions. He does what leaders do. He may not have the C on his jersey, but I think a lot of guys in that locker room look to him as a captain type of player with the presence that he has. And you know, it's gonna be, you know, he's gonna be a big priority for the Broncos when they get to the offseason, because his contract's up, and I know no one in this building wants to let him go because of what he's meant. And there's obviously the reality of the salary cap, but you know, you build franchises by finding and keeping and retaining and players like Chris Harris Jr. And I think this is just the beginning for him and also Von Miller.
As we head into the second half of the season, the Broncos will try and get back on track against the Raiders on Sunday. The game is at 2:05 Mountain Time on CBS. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll be back next week with more. Don't forget, you can subscribe on iTunes and enjoy the weekend and the game.